This is episode number 31 with Chris Hawker. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. What is up, all the greats out there? Hope you're having a fantastic week. And we've got a big episode today on the School of Greatness. It's with one of my early on mentors and now good friends, Chris Hawker. Now, for those that do not know who Chris Hawker is, he is a famous inventor, kind of behind the scenes type of guy, but in front of the scenes type of products. He's got over 30 products, I believe, on the market to date. He's been in everywhere as in Costco and Walmart and Bed Bath & Beyond and Best Buy and pretty much every type of consumer goods store you can think of. He's got some type of product or some type of influence in those stores. So this episode is all about, how does someone go from idea to landing on the shelves of Walmart? Or what does it take to come up with a great idea and become innovative in business? And we also talk about the importance of design and how this comes into play with your inventions or anything in life. So this is going to be a very interesting episode. I'm super pumped for this, having Chris in the studio here in LA. Very excited to share with you a wealth of his information. One of the smartest guys I've ever met, literally a genius, and couldn't be happier to have my good friend here in the studio. But before we get into that, want to give a quick shout out to the fan of the week. And I got a post on Instagram. I keep getting all your guys' pictures and posts of where you're watching the show. So keep it up. Keep tagging me on Instagram and sharing where you're watching, where you're listening to the School of Greatness all over the world. And this week is with Natalie Sisson. And she says, working out, overlooking an incredible view of the Strip of Las Vegas while listening to Lewis Howes' School of Greatness podcast, hashtag hustling, dream big, first million. And it's got a sweet view of the Strip with her on the treadmill going pretty fast. So thanks, Natalie Sisson, for the shout out. Pumped that you're listening while you're running. So without further ado, I am super pumped to introduce you to my mentor and good friend, Chris Hawker.
We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone if you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Whether you're searching for a home to buy or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. You can favorite homes, share listings with others, and even schedule tours with a local Redfin agent, all in the app. And when you're ready to buy, an experienced local Redfin agent can guide you through the whole process. They know how to help you win the right home at the right price. So download the Redfin app to get started today. Okay, quick math. The less your business depends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to NetSuite.com netsuite.com/greatness. netsuite.com/greatness. Again, head to netsuite.com/greatness.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming on today. I'm with my good friend and early mentor, Chris Hawker. What is up, Chris?
Hey, Lewis.
We are in my studio in Los Angeles. Beautiful view today, looking out the windows here of Los Angeles, Hollywood Hills, downtown.
Looks just like Ohio.
Yeah, right. Chris is from Columbus and is, in my mind, a very famous inventor. And we're talking about inventions in general today, but also innovation, design, designing your life, your business, all these good things. So I want to get started and kind of talk about inventions and first ask you a few simple questions. And how many products have you actually invented?
Well, I've helped bring over 70 products to market. Mm-hmm. Probably of my own conception, maybe a third of those were my own ideas. But I've also then collaborated with other inventors and companies to bring products to market. So the total number is a little over 70 right now, though we've got a few more on the way this year.
Over 70. And how many are currently being sold, I guess, or on the market?
Probably about half that number.
Half. Okay. So about 35.
A lot of products have a life cycle. They come and then sell for a while and then go. And so.
And where are your products at? Where are they located?
All over, pretty much every major retailer in America. So we've got products at Walmart, products at Target, products at grocery chains, specialty stores, Bed Bath & Beyond, niche markets, sporting goods, all over the place.
And tell me how you first got started.
Well, when I was a teenager, I worked in a fish store, and I started an aquarium maintenance business where I would set up fancy aquariums and doctor's offices in the homes of wealthy individuals. And I specialized in reef tanks, which are like fairly sophisticated saltwater aquariums with invertebrates, corals in particular. And I started having ideas for my own filtration products. So I learned from someone I found in the Yellow Pages who did acrylic fabrication, how to do acrylic fabrication. And then I worked with him to develop some of my filter ideas, which I would sell to my clients. So that was my first experience with doing sort of product development was protein skimming filters for saltwater aquariums. And then when I went to college, I went to Ohio State University, and I started when I went to college, I had to shut down my aquarium maintenance business, but I continued to try to manufacture and sell my filters, which were called the Trident series protein skimmers. Protein skimmer is a filter that scrubs protein using a column of aerated water from the water in order to purify it for the sensitive invertebrate creatures, which are very sensitive. So I started sort of not mass producing this, but making them and selling them through mail order, and did that through college, selling filtration components. And then the real breakthrough came as in my senior year of college, where I studied, actually got a degree in comparative religion from Ohio State. I was already kind of in business, so I was studying what my passion was, which was understanding humans and why they do what they do. That's what I was trying to figure out with that degree. But during my senior year, I started developing a professional quality algae scraper. So a tool to remove the algae that grows on the walls of the tank. And that, having been a professional algae remover, at the time, the only thing available was a sponge on a stick or a magnet scraper, which is fine if you've got one tank. But if you're cleaning tanks all day long, the magnet's inefficient and doesn't work very well. So I just wanted a high quality product that was like a carpenter's hammer. It didn't need to be miraculous. It just needed to not be junk. And I figured I wouldn't be the only person who would be interested in that. I thought I'd sell, a couple thousand to other professionals. Mm-hmm. And so I developed this by calling up companies who manufactured things, injection molders, or people who made different types of rods and materials, and just asking questions. I didn't know how to do anything, and no one around me to teach me. So in order to learn, I just started calling up factories and saying, hey, I'm trying to make an algae scraper. I did this nice drawing of what I think it should look like and how I think it should work. Can you give me some advice? And I got into a lot of dead ends where people were like, well, I don't know what to tell you. But I found certain people who were extremely willing to talk to me. And in particular, it turned out I had a family relative, Rex Clark, who had an injection molding company in Vancouver, Washington, as a distant cousin. And he taught me about injection molding, like top to bottom, explained all the ins and outs of how you can make a plastic part. And so with his tutelage and then instruction from other people who were willing to open up, and I found people were generally very willing, if I called them and asked them questions, to tell me everything. And so I finally sort of figured out all the components of this device, and then I started selling them. And the way I sold them was through a company called Kent Marine. So I didn't want to start a company and try to sell the products into the industry myself.
You licensed them.
So, well, that particular deal is what we call a private labeling arrangement. Mm-hmm. I bought the molds.
Sure.
With a loan from my parents, having blown all my money I had from selling filter components on beer in college.
Right.
And some travel, some road trips. But then, so my parents loaned me some money. I bought the molds, and I would sell. I struck a deal with Jack Kent at Kent Marine, who was a guy who I had met because he was buying some of my filter components. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, let's do an algae scraper. And so he would buy them and sell them, and I would get them made. And it was a real cool arrangement. He would place an order with me. I would place an order with the factory. The factory would ship the goods to him, and he would pay me, and I would pay the factory. So I never had to come up with the cash. He came up with the cash. And
you didn't have to warehouse them.
I didn't have to warehouse them. I didn't have to do anything. So I was basically acting as a broker.
You were drop shipping, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And we sold 35,000 units in the first year.
Wow.
So, yeah, it turned out...
More than 2,000.
More than 2,000. This afforded me the great privilege of never having to get a job with my religion degree. I was like, what am I going to do? So, started selling the algae scraper. And I was like... It immediately became, you know, much more successful than I ever imagined. I was like, wow, inventing is easy. This is an easy way to make money. I'm going to just do this over and over and start a company developing my inventions because I had a lot of ideas. I was engineers, people always think, oh, you could always tell he was an engineer because he would take the radio apart and fix it and then rebuild it. I was not that kid. I was a kid who would buy the radio, take it apart, and then stare at it and just admire how cool it was looking. So I had no idea how it worked. I was like not technical in that way, but I had a great appreciation for the parts and like the beauty of these designed components. And I mean, even as a very little kid, like 5, 6 years old, my mom would take me to garage sales. And what I would do is I'd buy things like old typewriters and radios, and I'd bring them home to take them apart. That was my hobby, taking things apart. Not to fix them or to understand them, but to appreciate them. So over the years, I just developed a strong appreciation and a palate, if you will, for what's cool, what turns me on. And so... Having done this algae scraper and had this success, I was like, oh, I know what's cool. That's what I was telling them. I know what's cool. I'm going to start just pumping stuff out. Boom.
Cool
boom.
Stuff.
Yeah, cool stuff. And that was my sort of dream when I started. So I ended up hiring an industrial designer and then a second industrial designer and, you know, developing to sell products. So after my algae scrapers, we expanded on that algae scraper line and then moved into guitar accessories. Immediately after college, I went to guitar building school in Phoenix at the Roberto Van School of Luthery, which is the only guitar building school in the world because I was a guitar player and it kind of fit in with this idea of being an inventor, being a product developer. And so then I branched and I decided not to pursue it as a career, though I did build a few guitars, which was a great experience. But I also learned that it's not a great way to make a living. It's a lot of hard
takes
work.
Months and months to get one guitar or something, right?
Yeah, and many hours, tedious work. I don't have the attention to detail or the patience, and it's kind of hard. It's basically like being a cabinet maker, only they pay you way less.
Wow.
because people just think, oh, a $2,500 guitar, that's an expensive guitar. And actually, that guy is making like 10 bucks an hour.
Wow.
if he made it himself, because of the amount of time, the cost of the materials, etc. So, but what I did do is then we started designing some guitar accessories. And basically, my next like 5 or 6 products totally flopped. I mean, just disastrous. We did like guitar string winder. And
when you thought it was going to be easy, the first one was a hit.
The first one was a hit. I got very lucky. Yeah. And Jack Kent, who was the man who owned the company who was selling the algae scraper, was really, I was very fortunate to run into this guy, because he took me under his wing. And even though I was selling him goods, he was like, well, here's how you should do this, Chris, because obviously you're just a young guy, but you seem like a sharp kid. I'm going to just take you under my wing. I mean, he was very explicit about it. And so he's like, you should charge me twice what you get him from the factory for.
Yeah, no.
And I was like, I was going to like charge him like way less than that.
Right.
So, he taught me about margins. He taught me about all the ins and outs of how you bring a product to market, how you get it made and sold. Though he specialized in chemical stuff. So the algae scraper was a hard good. And so he didn't know about that. I actually knew more about that than he did. So we developed this like great partnership and mentorship where he became my first real, you know, business mentor, other than my father, who had always been a businessman and sort of taught me some theories or ideas about business, he was an insurance agent. So he didn't really know anything that would directly help me with product development. So Jack became my first person there.
How important do you think it is to have a mentor early on?
I mean, I think there are very, very few instances of people who achieve any level of greatness without standing on the shoulders of other people who are eager, generally, looking for people who, young whippersnappers, up-and-comers, who they can hitch their wagon to because they can thrive on the energy. And you know, I find myself in that position, too. Like, for me, having the opportunity to share what I've learned gives me a legacy about, you know, I figured all this stuff out kind of the hard way. I had some mentors, but I've also cut my own path. And having gotten all this hard-won knowledge, I don't want it to stop with me. It's way more fun to share it and get other people doing what I'm doing. So
right. Well, it's fun having you on right now and talking about this, just because you were one of my first mentors. And you helped me in my growth so much. And that's something I talk about on the show a lot, is the importance of having mentors to reach basically the top or the next level or continuing getting the next level.
Well, and just to comment on that, I'll say in a really great mentorship relationship, the mentor learns just as much from the mentee as the other way around. So like when you came into my office and started showing up, Lewis had a...
Bugging you.
Bugging me. He had a desk. We gave him a desk in the kitchen of the office, and we would just go on walks every day and brainstorm about what he was doing, and he would brainstorm what I was doing. But I was teaching you about some basics of business and...
Inventing and product design and marketing and everything.
All those things. But I immediately began learning from you about passion and about focus and drive. Because you had those things in much greater quantity than I did. And so I was feeding off of you just as you were feeding off of me at the same time. And that's really like in a mentorship relationship, I think an important thing to understand is you want to pick students who aren't just taking, but they're giving back, because that's where you get the most value. And also it's the most fun. And plus, if you pick students who are going to go on to great things, it makes you look really good. So thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. When I first met Chris through my ex-girlfriend, because I was basically injured. I had a huge cast on and broken my wrist, just retired from football. And I made this like little cast sleeve, and I told my ex-girlfriend, I was like, God, I really want to like take this to market or sell it. And I was like, I need to find an inventor. And she was like, oh, I know a famous inventor. He's done like this big power squid and all these other products. And so you had just moved back, I think like 2 weeks before that.
I'd been in Santa Cruz, California for 3 years.
Yeah.
Taking a break from the weather Yeah.
And you just moved back, and I go, I have to meet this guy. Let's meet him. Like, I don't care where he's at. I'll stalk him. Let's go. And I show up, and I was like this thug, like showing up with a backwards cap, your baggy jeans, and like just getting out of playing football. And I had this thing on my cast. Didn't I have it on right then?
Yeah, you were wearing.
I was wearing this thing that I like sourced from China. And then I just bugged you. You're like, I don't have time for you. I'm like getting settled back in Columbus. And I was like, I will do whatever.
Right. He's like, I'll come in tomorrow and we'll talk. And I was like, all right, come in and we'll talk. And then the next day he's there too. And I'm like, okay, well, you can come in for an hour a day.
Yeah.
I get. And then pretty soon it was like just 5 days a week. And
yeah.
And there was a trade there too. You became my personal trainer. And
yes.
Then
yes.
You kicked my ass.
So I added value. I added value. I didn't just take.
Right. No, you were adding.
And that's a key to finding a good mentor, is like adding lots of value if right. possible.
Like if you're going to ask someone for their knowledge and wisdom, it's yeah. not, if it's a one way street, it'll run out of gas real
yeah,
fast.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would train you a few days a week at the gym with one arm.
Right.
Try to like do one arm pull ups with you or whatever. And then we would take walks and you'd teach me everything that you knew. It was amazing.
Yeah. I taught him everything he knows, people.
It was like a year and a half. It was about a year and a half of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A year and a half.
Yeah. It was a blast.
It was so fun. It was really a great thing. So
it was amazing. And you're originally like, we'll do this for like 3 to 6 months. And then it just was a year and a half.
Yeah. Well, we became great friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It was fun. And like I said, I mean, I was learning, I was getting at least as much from it as you were. So it was a real great thing. And I recognized instantly that, I mean, literally the minute I met you, I was like, I came home and I was like, Summer, that's my wife. I was like, I just met a guy who's like very interesting and he's going to be much more successful than I will be. I think. Like, he's got a drive that I've never encountered before. Mm. And I want to learn something about what he's got. So
interesting.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I'll say one of the skills that's driven my own success has been recognizing talent, whether it's in a person or if it's in an idea or a product, and to just instantly recognize something about it that like there's something there, there's something special, which like maybe towards the end of this conversation we can talk about noticing, which is I think a really important skill to develop if you want to innovate.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. When you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. Like when you're trying to buy tickets for the best seat at your favorite team's big game, or when you're hiring for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. With ZipRecruiter, you can find qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I believe finding the right team member is one of the most important steps in setting up my company for success. We like to ensure our new hires will be a good fit before they're even on the team. So I am grateful that I have ZipRecruiter's help when we want to grow the team fast. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Well, I think it's, you know, mentioning recognizing talent, but then knowing what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, anyone could maybe be like, oh, that's an interesting thing. But if they don't take action on it or whatever, then it's just an interesting idea.
Right, right.
And what you told me 5 years ago is that there are no million-dollar ideas, only million-dollar executions.
That's right.
So everyone can be like, this is a $1 million idea. This is going to make me millions. But if you don't execute the right way or leverage the talent or whatever it may be, then you really have nothing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I got stacks and stacks of ideas. Like
$1 million ideas.
Yeah. I got stacks of them. But there is, you know, it does help to start with the right idea.
Sure.
And the right person. So it's both. It's like right. Starting with the right kind of idea and then knowing what to do with it is the second half of the equation.
So now how do you find the right idea or become innovative in business or in life? How does someone innovate?
Well, when it comes to inventing, coming up with products, all the best ideas that I've experienced come from personal experience.
Mm.
So we deal at my company, Trident Design, with a lot of inventors. So we invent our own things, and then we also work with companies and inventors who have their own ideas. And so they come to us and, you know, here's my idea. What do you think? You know, does this have legs? And some of those people come to us with ideas that they came up with because they're trying to get rich. You know, I want to invent something, and then it's like winning the lotto. I'm going to come up with this great idea and I'm going to be rich. It's going to be awesome. And then other people come up with an invention because they need it desperately.
Mm.
I have been scraping aquariums and with a sponge on a stick, and it's garbage, and I need a high quality tool. Why does the carpenter get a nice hammer and I get a sponge on a stick? So, you know, so I needed it. It was for me. But it turned out there were a lot of people like me who were tired of suffering with the low quality stuff. So, you know, you could be a surgeon and need a new surgical device. You could be a, you know, police officer and need something to help you with your job. You could be a passionate hobbyist of, you know, a winemaker or whatever it is. But then out of your own personal experience, you come up with a problem that needs to be solved. And no one's done the right thing. There isn't a solution yet, or you don't think there is one. So drawing on your personal experience, either your job or your hobby or your passion, to identify the ideas is where most of the best invention ideas come from, because you know the customer. Whereas if you're trying to just make money, who's the customer? You're not really, you know, haven't identified a customer. The customer is like some theoretical person that you don't know intimately well. But if you design something that is for someone just like you, and you know that if you saw this thing, you would have to buy it because it fulfilled a need that you desperately had, then there's a good chance that that product's going to succeed.
Mm.
And so that's where product ideas come from. And and so I guess
that's... So filling a need is usually the best one.
Yeah, for coming
for
up
yourself.
With... For yourself.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, if you become a professional in an industry of a product company, you develop a skill to know what the market needs, not based on personal experience.
Sure.
So companies innovate in a different way based on intimate knowledge of a category and what's out there and seeing holes in the marketplace. But inventors, independent inventors, or people trying to come up with new things, not just incremental improvements, need to draw on their own experience.
So it's one thing to innovate and find great ideas, but really monetizing those ideas is, you know, how you build a business, I guess. So how does someone go from taking an idea to getting into Walmart? And I know there's many steps, I guess, or phases or facets, but how do you, what's like, you know, the quick overview?
Yeah. Well, so if someone has an idea for a product and they want to get it on the market, basically there are two paths. You can either start a company and make it, or you can license it. Mm. So starting in a company and making it is kind of the obvious answer, though it's the hard one. And then the easy one is develop it to a certain point, and then typically you get a patent or a patent, you file for patent protection, and then you license the intellectual property protected by that patent to another company who will make it, sell it, and pay you a royalty. So why you would choose one of those paths comes down to, you know, a few factors. So if you're going to start a company, you have to be able to afford it, both time-wise, emotionally, and financially. So if you don't have the wherewithal to gather the funds, either because you have them or can raise them, then starting a company is not an option for you.
Yeah.
And if you want to keep your day job as a police officer, because, or your night job, you like, that might be, you like your job. You just had an idea and you want to make money from it, but you're not prepared to come up with $100,000 and start going to trade shows and dealing with China or wherever the thing's being made and having inventory and employees. And, you know, you can't do it casually. Starting a company, if you look out at the world, you don't see too many companies that make products that are run as just an off, you know, on the side business.
Sure.
Most of them are run by teams of people, you know, large teams of people who work 70 hours a week. You know, I mean, it's not a small task. So the biggest factor, other than that wherewithal issue, then is lifestyle choice. Mm. Like, what do you want from your life? And like, one of the things we say at Trident is like, not every great idea is an economic opportunity for you. So like, like if you invent a new type of internal combustion engine and you're not Ford, you know, like it's going to be tough to monetize that. Mm. So if you come up with an invention idea that is, you know, really, really big, and you're not a really, really big company, then it or a really, really ballsy, audacious person like Elon Musk or something like that, you're not going to find that to be a productive path. So, right. You know, it kind of comes back to that first idea, too, about like what's the best idea. I guess a point I forgot to mention is important to invent something or have an idea whose scale is within your reasonable reach.
So what type of things do you guys invent in general?
We're doing simpler consumer products mostly, but we also do medical devices and things with, you know, ranging from consumer electronics, housewares products, hardware products. Most famously, the Power Squid, which you mentioned earlier, which is a power strip with flexible outlets. So it looks like a squid, and the outlets are on their end of little extension cords. That was actually my own invention and has been my most successful product to date. It's sold several million units. It's licensed to Philips. It's now coming out under the GE brand. It's out under Stanley brand.
It's in Bed Bath & Beyond, Costco, everything, right?
It's been in those places. Yeah. It's, you know, it's come and gone in a lot of places. And,
right.
And it's past its heyday, but it's...
There's been a lot of knockoffs, too.
And there's been knockoffs. And, you know, like I said, every product has its life cycle. So it came and had a great show, won a bunch of awards, lots and lots of media press. And really, that product came out in 2005. I thought of it in 2001. Mm. And then I licensed it. So, you know, back on the licensing option, quick is relative, you know.
Yeah.
People think quick and they think, you know, oh, Tiny Wings app was programmed in a weekend and then that guy became a millionaire. So, like, people think the all the news stories about apps and have people thinking, oh, product is, you can like get rich overnight. But an average time frame from like idea to marketplace, if you're starting from scratch as an inventor, is realistically 3 to 6 years.
Mm.
Like, it's not a fast thing because of all the steps from A to Z that have to happen. Like, you have to have the idea, you have to develop the product, you have to develop a presentation, you have to file for a patent. Now you have to find someone to license it to, which is a huge task and can take a very long time because you're like identifying targets, trying to chase down meetings. Then you get the meetings, then you got to present the product, you got to get them interested. And if you're just an independent solo inventor,
It's very challenging.
It's very challenging because a lot of companies have what I call an immune response to inventors. They like have been burned in the past by crazy inventors who, you know, I know inventors, and some of them are indeed quite
crazy.
Well, by crazy, I mean they have far more passion than perspective.
Sure.
So they're not like literally crazy, though there are some of those too. But but there's just a lot of people who have unrealistic expectations based on things that they've seen in the media that aren't real, right, or that are like the one in a million story that made the news because it was the one in a million story. But the vast majority of products are not grand slam home runs that made someone rich overnight. They were base hits or doubles that occurred after years and years of effort. And so, yeah, but the Power Squid came out in 2005, you know, after I licensed it to a company called Power Century, which was owned by Fiskars, the office products company. And then it launched and it took off very fast. So it was like an overnight success made in 4 or 5 years. So it wasn't 20 years, but it was several years in the making. And then it came out and it took off and ultimately sold, you know, several million units, brought in over $1 million in royalties. And so that's, you know, the licensing side. So you can make the product or you can license it. And the great thing about licensing is you stop your efforts when the entrepreneur is just beginning. You get to keep your day job. You collect a check, usually on a quarterly basis, based on the sales of the product that someone else is taking all the effort to do.
To promote, to manufacture, and to ship, to whatever, sell.
To insure.
Yeah.
Warehouse. I mean, there's
everything.
It's a very complicated number of things to do. And I don't want to discourage people from starting companies that make and sell products, because people start companies and make and sell products and get rich all the time doing that. But you have to go in with your eyes open, knowing that it's going to be a lifestyle.
Right.
You're starting a company.
Yeah.
And you need to do that with your eyes open. And I see many lives ruined by people blindly going into like, oh, I'm going to start a company and do this thing. And they don't get sound advice, and pretty soon they've got a warehouse full of
inventory
you
can't sell.
Yeah, because everyone's like, oh, once I'll just get some inventory and then I'll sell it, it'll be easy. And I'm here to say the hardest part in the equation is selling the goods. Developing and inventing stuff is fun and easy,
and you've done both. You've started side companies of products, like the Thirsty Light was one where you manufactured, you did everything, you try to sell it all. And that's one that I was involved in, you know, doing PR for, like in the kitchen for, you know, weeks and weeks. But
yeah, I have. I've manufactured quite a few things, and today I manufacture nothing. I focus exclusively on licensing. We help other people to make things. But for my own interest, making and selling things smacks of work, and I have an allergy to to work. I like to play all day and inventing stuff, talking to people, you know, cutting deals. This to me feels like play.
It's more fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're solely focusing on licensing, but creating as well. You have a whole design team of designers, industrial designers, right? But basically it's all about licensing now.
That's for my own ideas.
Right. For you.
So, yeah.
So inventors come to you as well and they say, hey, I've got this idea. How does it work? If you like the idea, then you say, okay, I can make this for you for a certain price.
Right.
And then I can help you take it and license it for you.
Yeah. So Trident does, you know, we're basically two things. We're product development and commercialization, and then all the things involved with both of those fields. So we have a team of industrial designers and engineers and graphic designers and marketers and video producers who can put all the pieces together to help someone develop and then launch a product, whether they're going to whether they want to license it or whether or not
themselves.
They want to sell themselves. And then we have licensing agents. So if they want to license it, that's something we do. If they want to sell it themselves, then obviously they're building a company. And
you just pass it off to them.
Just like a company who hires us to do industrial design, which we do quite a bit of as well, where corporations will hire our team to develop new products for them, in particular inventions. So like people come to us if they need an inventive new solution or new angle on something, because our specialty is not styling, it's inventing, coming up with new ways to do old things. And so we've sort of developed this skill set where we know how to look at things from a fresh perspective and come up with ideas that, you know, are new, but usually not that it's not like they're complicated. They're like things that are hidden in plain sight.
Mm.
But everyone else is blinded by the past. So, you know, this is how a stapler has always been made. You know, this is what it looks like. This is what a stapler is. And so, that, you know, one of the secrets to transforming a product and innovating is to not look at a stapler as a stapler, but to look at a stapler as a paper connecting system.
Mm.
So you're like, okay, we're trying to connect paper. Are there other options? And what would be the best way, given all the possibilities that exist today, both in materials and technology and mechanisms and manufacturing capabilities? Because so often people see what's been done before, they decide that's what the thing is, and then if they're going to improve on a stapler, they just try to make a slightly
cooler looking one,
or they add a little feature to it.
Right.
And I haven't worked on a stapler, that's just a case in point. But you know, the Power Squid's a great example where everyone was making
strips.
And then as the transformer plugs, the charger plugs started proliferating, as cell phones gave rise, pretty soon everyone had all these plugs. And if you're trying to plug them into a normal power strip, you'd cover up three outlets with one plug, and it'd be very frustrating. And then so you'd have six outlets, but you could only use two or three at the most. And even to use those, you were like doing what I call the plug juggle, like trying to figure out what's the puzzle that allows you to fit them all in there. So it's kind of annoying. And then like once you had, you know, two things plugged in, now like to get the third thing there, you can't pull it to where you're at. So it had all these constraints. And the way people were trying to solve that at the time was making the strips bigger and bigger and spreading out the outlets more. And so the strips were just getting like really huge. And so the Power Squid, you know, was just a fresh take. Like, well, why can't we have those little extension cords? And the way that happened was one night I was looking at my stereo. And I was up, you know, late one night having a little insomnia. And I looked over at, you know, the stereo, saw the power strip with all the cords, the mess of cords. And for some brief moment, I saw the cords coming out of it instead of into it.
Mm.
And then I was like, wait a second. That's cool. So I like quickly did this little drawing, labeled it the Power Blossom. and then I brought it into my office the next day. And this is kind of in the early days of Trident. And, you know, by the end of the day, it become a squid. And then that started a whole series of events that eventually led to that product coming out. So that comes back to that noticing thing I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. So a lot of people probably saw that same thing or had this similar idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the skill I've tried to develop over the years is noticing when I have an idea that might have legs.
Mm. So how do you notice something?
By trying to. By developing attention to wanting to notice when something crosses your mind, and instead of letting it come in and go out and never to be seen again, when you hear something or you see something, or a lot of times I'll come up with an invention because I'll be like flipping through a magazine and I'll think I see something and I'm just like flipping through it, and then it's like, wait a second, what did I just see? That was a cool idea. And then, but it wasn't actually what was there. It was I missaw it, kind of like when I missaw the power strip and saw the cords coming out of it. I'll just like have seen something. I thought I saw something that was really cool. I'll flip back and it wasn't there. That's not what it was. It was something else. But the thing that I thought it was something cool, something with potential. And so then I like write it down. And then the next step. So getting back to the process. The next step after having that idea that either comes from your personal experience or from or noticing it, it's usually a combination of those, having that personal experience, then noticing that there's something missing, is then to do research. Because just because you think, well, I've never seen that before, it must not exist.
But there might be a patent on it already.
Or it might exist and you weren't looking for it before. You're like, oh, I had an idea and I've never seen this before. But then people just assume it doesn't exist rather than thinking that
start like making it without
it's amazing what I've seen people do, like spend hundreds of thousands of dollars pursuing something without ever doing research.
And they do research, but they don't look for it in detail. They see what they want to see, right?
Well, there's what they call the confirmation bias. So people are looking to find what they want to find. So if they're looking, you know, if I was looking at the power squid now, you know, I was like, oh, great idea. Now let's do some research and make sure it's not actually out there. And I just missed it. And that just because I hadn't seen it before didn't mean it's not out there. And I just hadn't noticed it. And so then, you know, you look around and if you look at the first page and you search tentacled power strip, right? And then it's not there. And you're like, woohoo, I'm home free, you know? Yeah. And you're like, well, did you search power strip with extension cords, or did you search power strip flexible power, you know? But usually because of confirmation bias, people like prove to themselves on the first page that it doesn't exist, and then they stop because they don't want to find bad news. So they're looking actually to not find it rather than looking to find it. So that you got to get real serious. It's very helpful to get a third party, a patent attorney or research firm.
That's what you guys do too, right?
Yeah, we do that. It's the first step of any process. We have a research staff that we look into the patents and the market landscape thoroughly, and we spend 20 hours digging on any project, because it would be horrible to invest thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in a product. And I have done this only to find out that it was out there already. You know, like some of those early mistakes I made, some of those early flops, bad decisions were me, you know, making the mistake of thinking that I knew what was out there because I hadn't seen it. And so in the fortunate success of that algae scraper early on afforded me a lot of mistakes. And so I was able to make a lot of products and have them fail and learn lessons from those. And I was very clear that I needed to learn. I mean, I knew I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
You know, I knew that one product didn't make me an expert, but I knew that I was committed to this career path because it was fun.
Yeah.
Like the first time I went into a store and saw my product hanging on the shelves, I was hooked. Because for me, that was like, look, I'm anonymously famous. It's like anonymous fame.
I made that.
Yeah, I made that. There's someone looking at it. Oh, they're buying it. Oh my God, I just made $2. You know, and that's now going to be in their home. And a little piece of me is in that house. And now there's little pieces of me in millions of households. So that's, you know, it's an interesting feeling. Often I will walk into someone's house and see a product that I invented or helped bring to market. Yeah, there's, oh, hi, Squiddy. So, and so that was what for me made it really exciting, was just to realize that in a little way I was impacting people's lives. And so my personal bent, you know, some of our clients are surgeons who invent orthopedic surgical devices that are incredibly complex and, you know, over my head, but not over the head of the brilliant engineers and designers that I've got. And so we figure these things out and help them to get them to market. But my own inventions tend to be these, like, I think humble items, things like power strips or recently I...
Onion goggles.
Yeah. Onion goggles. So you don't cry when you chop onions. Famous product, very successful product. Yeah. Worn on TV all the time by celebrity chefs. And if you go on Flickr and search onion goggles, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of selfies of people wearing onion goggles. It's like a thing to do just randomly. And Phil on The Modern Family wore the onion goggles.
That's right.
And I have a picture of myself next to the TV. I'm wearing the onion goggles. And so is Al Bundy.
Right? There you go.
I forget the actor's name, but he's Al Bundy to me anyway. Right. So that's just cool. And anyway, so just to get back to the process. So after you've done the research and you've determined that, in fact, there does appear to be an opening, then you've got to develop the product. And this is, you know, the onion goggle segues way nicely into this, because when you execute your product, the thing is you're turning your idea now into a product. You've got to turn it into a great product, because that's what succeeds. You know, that's why Apple rose to the top. And there was a lot of execution side to it, and a lot of the execution was in creating relentless pursuit of great products. Like, so many people think, well, Apple can do that because they're Apple, but we can't do that because we're not. And, you know, and all these companies say, well, you know, we want to be great, but we just can't afford to to take the kind of, you know, attention to detail that Apple does, because, you know, we don't have, but that's how Apple got there.
Mm-hmm. They weren't always that way.
They weren't always that way. Lewis Howes was not always, you know, the famous social network entrepreneur that he is today, and he didn't wait until he became that to become powerful. He started powerful, and then it happened for him because of that. Mm. And so it's the same way with products. Like, you got to create a great product. Great products. If you make a great product that works very well, has great design, and is based on a great idea, it will succeed. Mm. I guarantee it. If the product is great, it will succeed. If the product fails, then there was something about it that was not great. Mm. I guess the other piece of that equation is, and the value is great, meaning how much you get for your dollar. So if you create the world's greatest product and you've got a, you know, $1,000 vegetable peeler, it's not. So part of greatness is value density. Mm. A term I've developed, which means like you're getting more for your money. So if you create a, you know, the onion goggles, you could use shop goggles. You could use chemistry goggles. They're just glasses that protect your eyes from the fumes. And they could have been $5 gimmicky, silly things. And a lot of people thought it was a silly idea. And there's a lot of haters on the internet for the onion goggles. Oh, there's a monotasker, silly product, though. They're also
comfortable, and they're
hundreds of thousands of extremely passionate fans of the onion goggles, because they work. And they were made very nice. They're $20. They have anti-fog coating. They're made very nicely. They come in a case.
Nice, so that design.
They look cool. We designed them so they look very distinctive. They don't look like any other type of goggle. They are onion goggles. They've become what onion goggles are. And now when people knock off onion goggles, which has happened several times, they look just like ours, because everyone just is blinded by the past. They're like, oh, onion goggles look like this.
Right.
We established that benchmark. Now that other people are copying.
Right.
So that's what we call a knockoff, is when, and you know, any successful product's going to be knocked off. And a knockoff, by definition, is just a cheaper version that's lower quality. And it's not a bad thing. It's an inevitable thing. They're going to happen. Mm. If you knock something off, but you make it better, that's not called a knockoff. It's called an innovation. Mm. That's what an innovation is.
Interesting.
So the onion goggles succeeded because we executed so well on the product, and then they became a sensation and have sold extremely well. And again, that was a product that was licensed, so we collect a royalty on the back end. And the royalty in a typical product is 5%.
5%.
Yeah, I mean, the range is like 3 to 8 for a typical product. The 5 is normal, and that's on wholesale sales, the price that the manufacturer sells it to the retail store for. And a lot of people hear that number, they're like, 5%?
It's nothing.
That's terrible.
This is my idea.
Yeah. Well, a well-run manufacturer, based on almost infinite data from hundreds of years, and makes 10% to 12% bottom line. So you sell something for, you know, $20 retail, well, it wholesales for 10, because that pretty typically, because people are doubling their money. But then you've got material costs. So, you know, if you're selling it for 10, that means usually that you paid somewhere like $5 or $6 for it. So you're actually only getting $4 in margin. Now you got to pay sales commission. Now you got returns and defect allowances from the retailer.
Your overhead.
Now you've got secretaries and warehouse people and blah, 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 blah. And after all those costs, you're making 10%. The inventor is getting 5. The person who's taking all the risk, taking all the effort, doing all the hard labor of bringing that product, this is why it sounded like work to me, is like getting double of what you're getting for doing nothing.
Right.
It's an amazing deal for the inventor.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's actually, at some level, it's like overly fair to the inventor, except for the fact that that's the person who had the idea, and they created value around it, and then they protected it, and then they took the biggest risk. Right. So they're getting the biggest proportional reward of anyone in the equation, bigger than the retailer. Like, the retailer is doubling their money. They're getting 50% margins. Yeah, but they've got to pay for a store and employees and warehouse. I mean, it's
insurance and all that
stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's not like most retailers are making, they're making 10% too.
Yeah.
So all these things, because of the efficiencies of the marketplace, have been driven down where like everyone's making 10% in the normal value chain on their money. And so it's a very fair deal
for
the inventor.
And you had a pretty recent success with the hot dog slicer, right?
Yeah.
What's it called? The hot dog.
Hot dog slicer.
Hot dog slicer. And so an inventor
cleverly named hot dog slicer. Well, we wanted to call it the safety dog, but an inventor came to us with the idea of doing a cute hot dog cutter that would cut up your hot dog into little chunks that were not choking hazards. Hot dog is the number one choking hazard for children.
Mm.
Kills quite a few kids each year because the hot dog shaped just like a cork. And so the guy comes to us with this idea, and this is how our business works. If someone's going to license their product, he paid us a fee to develop his idea to do a hot dog cutter into a product. We came up with the idea that it should look like a wiener dog, and then figured out how it would work. You have a little tray, put the hot dog on it, you press the wiener dog over it, and viola, you get a bunch of little hot dog chunks. And then there's a little bowl in front of the dog that holds the ketchup. So It's super cute. And the reason we chose that is, like, back to that, great design is like, well, part of a lot of people think the design is just the aesthetics. It's just making something pretty after you've designed it. But really, the aesthetics is part of the function. We call it the human function. So that's how you cause a product to engage with the end user. And successful products today, especially, are really engaging the human, not just getting the job done, but appealing to the person, helping them understand what the product does and what the value of that product is to them. And then with the hot dog slicer, we realized, well, who's buying this? Why are they buying it? Is it moms afraid of their kids choking to death? Safety products are like that generally. The data says they don't sell well. But a cute little dog for eating your hot dogs is adorable and costs $3.50 at Walmart, sells like crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll ship well over 1 million units this year. And so we developed it, prototyped it, filed for a patent, and then shopped it around. And then we found a person, a company to license it after considerable effort. And that company then manufactured it and sold it to Walmart. And it's sold on a clip strip next to the hot dog buns. So
amazing.
Yeah. And then Dan, the inventor, makes, a share.
His percentage,
60% of that's our deal. And then we get 40%. It'll generate on for him what was like a $10,000 investment, probably over $500,000 in revenue by the time it's done, based on the success it's had. Now, the other side of that coin is that we've developed a lot of products that don't succeed. I mean, we're very good, but we don't have a crystal ball, and you just can't always win. I mean, you get the products out there, and then ultimately the consumer has to respond. And so we've had we've had our share of successes, and we've had our share of failures. We've had our share of products we've developed which have never made it to market. So we try very, very hard with every one of them, but it's just, you can't bat 1,000. You can't even bat 500. I think we bat around 300, so we feel pretty good about that.
Right. Well, I feel like we could talk for hours on this stuff, and there's a lot that I want to cover, probably in the next one, on FIP, which is one of your philosophies, and I won't spoil it for everyone now. We'll have you come back on again and talk about that and a lot of other things on inventions and innovation and designing your life, because I think that's what's really cool for me to learn about. So, but until the next time, let's have you answer the question, what's your definition of greatness?
So I'll say, I'll define greatness for myself, not how I define greatness for other people, but like what I'm trying to do in myself to be great is, I think greatness for me, Chris Hawker, it's what I call being integral. So trying to be great in every aspect of my life. So living up to my potential, embracing life in all of its aspects. So in my career, in my family, in my body. I'm not an athlete like you are, but I practice Tai Chi and Kung Fu and try to stay fit, eat healthy. I, try to have a great relationship with my family and my friends, like really great, deep connections with my family and friends, as well as being well-read, as well as traveled, as well as being an inventor and an idea thought leader. So for me, that's my path, is trying to really be great in all these different areas.
Be great at everything.
Well, as great as I can be.
Right.
You know, like I'm not, for you. I'm not measuring myself against other people, just against myself.
Right. Right. Gotcha.
Am I living up to my potential, or trying to at least?
Love it. Well, where can people find you online, Chris?
I'm at trident-design.com, or you can get me on Twitter at InventorChris. And we got a Facebook page as well. So please, nice. Yeah, feel free. If you got ideas, we want to hear them. You know, we'd love to talk to you. It's free to talk to us and get some feedback on whether your idea has legs, whether it is, you know, an economic opportunity for you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's fun. I mean, inventing is like kite surfing. It's like, it's a hard thing.
Challenging, but fun.
Challenging, but fun. And if you can master it, you'll be the coolest guy on the block. It's cool. It's fun. And it's exciting.
I love it. Thanks, Chris. And we'll have to have you come back on sometime soon and talk about everything else.
It'd be my pleasure.
Awesome.
Thanks, Lewis.
There you have it, greats. There are no such thing as a $1 million idea, only $1 million executions. So pumped that I could finally get Chris on the show, as he's been a mentor and a friend for a long time. Make sure to check out his site, trident-design.com, and look at all the cool stuff that he's been up to lately, all the different inventions that he's created and put out there in the market. If you've got an idea for a product or an invention, feel free to go to his site. There's a form. You can call their office and check it out. And I highly recommend it, as they are extremely successful at taking ideas that inventors have, bringing them to market, licensing them, and all that other good stuff. So make sure to check Chris out. Also, want to give a quick shout out to the review of the week. And this is over on iTunes. Customer review of the week goes out to Alex Designs. And Alex said on the headline, "Listen and follow greatness -repeat. He said, "The best way to have true wealth in life is to model greatness. Lewis brings great interviews to his show. I just addicted and I can't stop listening." So thanks so much, Alex, for the review. And there are a lot of other reviews out here. But please, if you have not sent us a review or written us a review, go ahead over to iTunes and just leave a quick comment, click on the ratings and leave your rating. I'd love to hear your feedback, good or bad. I would love to hear whatever you have to say, but just please leave us a review so I know how to improve it for you in the future. And with that, guys, we've got a few killer episodes coming up in the coming weeks. I'm going to start posting these a couple times a week and see how that works for the next month. So get ready for greatness coming out at you twice a week. With that, you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and make sure to do something great.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. Capella University's game-changing FlexPath format helps you learn at your own pace and fit earning a degree into your life. From before you enroll to after you graduate, you'll be supported by people who are invested in your success so you can pursue your goals, knowing that help is available if you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.